KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, The New Yorker's award-winning climate writer Elizabeth Colbert will talk about her fascinating new book, H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. And in her book, A is not for Apple. Also, Judith Butler, maybe the most famous feminist theorist in the world today. Now Butler has a new book out with the provocative title, Who's Afraid of Gender? Katha Pollitt will provide a critique. But first, the most important event in the history of Israel and Palestine was not in 1948, the founding of Israel and the Nakba, the expulsion of Palestinians. It was not in 1967, when Israel occupied Palestinian territories. It was in 1924, when the United States outlawed the immigration of most Jews and others to the United States from Russia, Poland, and Eastern Europe. That was the purpose of the Immigration Restriction Act passed by Congress 100 years ago this month. Without that, the Jews of Europe would never have moved to Palestine. That's what Harold Meyerson argues. He's editor at large of The American Prospect. We reached him today in our nation's capital. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, I taught 20th century American history for decades. I always gave a lecture on immigration restriction and the importance of the 1924 law. I never made the connection to the establishment of the State of Israel. You did it in an article at prospect.org. It is a brilliant argument. Thank you for that.
You're very welcome.
So, you point out, it's the 100th anniversary on May 26th of the Immigration Restriction Act, the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, passed by Congress, signed by Calvin Coolidge, Republican president. Before that, there had been open immigration from Europe. That act did what?
Well, it stopped open immigration from every place except Northwestern Europe through, first of all, putting an overall annual limit on immigration to the United States of 150,000. In the years before World War I, more than a million people were coming every year, and they were coming from Southern Europe, Italy and Greece, and even more so Eastern Europe, Russia and Poland. Poland then, of course, was governed by Russia. There was no independent Poland until after World War I. So it was, to put it mildly, an ethnically exclusive law, and it was passed in a wave of white Protestant phobias about America becoming less white Protestant, the great replacement theory of its time.
One interesting point here is that the system of national quotas that was made law in 1924 was based on the American population of 1890, which was 34 years before this law was passed. The most recent census had been 1920. Why did they pick 1890?
Well, they wanted to allocate the number of immigrants based on where the population of 1890 or their ancestors came from. And at that point, there were relatively few Americans who could point to ancestors who came from Italy or Poland or Russia or Romania. At that point, it was Germany, Ireland, mainly Britain, also Scandinavia and France. That's what the power establishment of the United States wanted. So they had to go back to the 1890 census to find some statistical model that would keep out the Catholics and the Jews.
The numbers are astounding. The numbers in the change of immigration. This is the most astounding part of your article. What proportion of Eastern European Jewish immigrants came to the United States before 1924? And what proportion went to Palestine?
Roughly 85% of the little over 2 million Jews who fled Tsarist Russia and Tsarist Poland, or later on, the early days of the USSR and independent Poland, 85% of them came to the United States. Only 3% went to Palestine. Now, this was after the Balfour Declaration saying Jews could have a state in Palestine. They still kept coming to the United States for a number of years after that, until this law was passed by Congress.
And what was the Jewish population of Palestine, say, at the end of World War I?
It was only 60,000, which was a little under a one-tenth of the total population of Palestine. And it was less than the number of Jews who had come to Canada. It was less than the number of Jews who had come to Argentina. So to pick a phrase, which is much in use these days, there wasn't that much settler colonialism. There was more, let's get out of Eastern Europe where there are pogroms, and let's go to the New World. And by the New World, they did not mean Palestine.
So I want to zero in on the years in America immediately preceding the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924. World War I ended 1918. Travel from Eastern Europe had been impossible for the previous 4 years. Now travel was open again. What was immigration like to the United States in the early 20s? And what was American politics like?
Well, it continued to flow from Eastern and Southern Europe. Meanwhile, American politics was beginning to center on nativism and xenophobia. The Ku Klux Klan, which had more or less subsided, revived after the D.W. Griffith movie, Birth of a Nation. But by the 1920s, it was mainly centered in the North, not the South. The state with the most number of Klansmen was Indiana. And it was mainly an organization of white Protestants who, yeah, they didn't like blacks, but their main concern was that there were Jews and Catholics who were undermining the Protestant character of America and who were particularly, you know, overtaking a number of American cities.
So are you saying that the newly revived Klan was the main source of congressional concern about excessive immigration of Jews and Catholics?
Well, it was a major one, but let's not think of the Klan as this kind of lumpen organization comprised entirely of lower class yahoos. It was an organization that businessmen and politicians joined. And I would point out that the 1924 Democratic National Convention tied itself in knots on a resolution to condemn the Klan, which the rural elements of the Democratic Party were clearly opposed to, and the urban Jewish Catholic machines of cities like New York were the ones who introduced it. So it affected the whole political climate. But look, the leading Senate exponent of stopping immigration across the Atlantic, except from Britain and a few other Northwestern European nations, was Henry Cabot Lodge, the epitome of the American establishment, senator from Massachusetts. So this was not a marginal concern, that it went beyond the Klan. And you see aspects of it referred to in The Great Gatsby, even some references to it in The Sun Also Rises. So this is a dominant theme of mid-1920s America.
So you've said millions of Jews came from Eastern Europe to the United States before the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act was passed. How many came per year after that?
Well, the way I calculated it, based on the national origins going back to the 1890 census, then updated to the 1920 census, was that for all the nations of Eastern Europe, about 15,000 people could come in a given year. By no means were all of those Jewish. By no means were all of those from Russia or Poland. So, you know, maybe 5,000, 6,000, as opposed to the 150,000, 200,000, which were coming a year before World War I.
And then, of course, we had the rise of fascism and anti-Semitism in Germany and Poland and Hungary. Jews who could no longer get into the United States then started going to Palestine. Again, your statistics tell the story. How much did the Jewish population of Palestine change between 1932 and 1939?
Yeah, the Jewish population of Europe, most of them understood it would be better to get out than stay once Hitler had come to power in Germany in 1933 and increasingly loomed over the rest of Europe. So the 3% of European Jewish emigres who, Eastern European Jewish emigres who went to Palestine in previous years went up to almost 50%, I think 46-49%, something like that in the immediate years preceding World War II, because they couldn't get into the United States.
Let's talk about Zionism as a political ideology and as a political movement, the idea of building a Jewish state. How much of the emigration to Israel up to 1939 was the pull of Zionist Jewish nationalism? How much of it was the push of fascist anti-Semitism, do you think?
Well, how much of it was the fact that they couldn't come to the United States? That's the key variable on which everything hinges. Look, Zionism was an official doctrine propounded by Theodor Herzl back in 1896. It was there either for Jews to embrace or nod sagely and ignore. And clearly, the appeal of Zionism only really hit home when Palestine was the one place that they could go to and escape Europe. It wasn't the ideology. It was a question of which doors were open and which doors were shut.
So the millions of Jews of Poland, Russia, and Eastern Europe who were faced with anti-Semitism wanted to come to the United States, not to Palestine. And that's what they did as long as the United States would let them in. Meanwhile, in Palestine, of course, everything changed after World War II. There's an important chapter here when there were a million Jews who survived World War II in Europe. Most of those Jewish survivors were still not allowed to emigrate to the United States. That story is told in an indispensable book, The Last Million by David Nassau. That 1 million European Jews who had survived the Holocaust spent 3 to 5 years after the war living in displaced person camps in Poland and in Germany and other places. The United States didn't allow them in. Most other countries didn't want them either. And then in 1948, we have the partition of Palestine. We have Israel's declaration of independence. And many of those people still in DP camps went to Israel. And of course, the new Israelis expelled the Palestinians. Then the 1967 war and the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza made everything much worse.
You know, when the State of Israel was founded in 1948, the Sephardic Jews living in other Middle Eastern countries, Iraq, Egypt, and there were quite a number of them, they had to flee as well. But that 1924 law was still on the books. And so they went to Israel as well. This didn't only affect, by this metric, Russian and Polish Ashkenazic Jews. It affected the Sephardic Jews of the Middle East as well. That law was on the books until the Great Society Congress of 1965 repealed it and ended the preferences for and discrimination against different nations when it came to immigration. So it really plays the decisive role, I would say, shaping the Jewish-Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The xenophobia, the nativism, the bigotry that was at large in the United States in the 1920s and took the form of a congressional act that really shaped the Middle East fundamentally.
And do you see any parallels to that spirit today in America?
Yeah, in an odd way, or not so odd a way, we're back to the same kind of nativist xenophobia. People are struggling to get into the United States because life in their homelands is too violent, is changing for people who relied on agricultural work. The changes in climate no longer facilitate that kind of work. Those people are coming to the United States for the same reasons that people came to the United States from Russia, Poland, and elsewhere in 1910, because there's a way they can get in and they got to get out of where they live. It is producing the same kind of nativist backlash that had the very unfortunate effect of being the catalyst for much of the tragedy that's the ongoing story of Israel and Palestine.
Harold Meyerson of the American Prospect. Harold, thank you for this terrific article.
You are very welcome and always good to be here, John.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. There's a story behind climate change, and Elizabeth Colbert has found an ingenious way of telling it in her new book. It's an A to Z narrative, 26 short chapters, one for each letter of the alphabet, gorgeously illustrated. Elizabeth Colbert is one of our great science journalists. That's what the New York Times says. She won a Pulitzer Prize for her book, The Sixth Extinction. We talked about it here. She's been a New Yorker staff writer for 25 years. Her work there has received two National Magazine Awards and a prize from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her new book is called H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. Elizabeth Colbert, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. In most alphabet books, A is for apple. And there's certainly a story to tell about how climate change is affecting apple growing. But in your book, A is not for apple. What is it for?
In my book, A is for Arrhenius. And Arrhenius, Svante Arrhenius, and I'm sorry for your Swedish-speaking listeners if I'm mispronouncing his name. But he was a very eminent Nobel Prize winning chemist, actually. And in the late 1890s, there was a lot of debate about what caused ice ages. And Svante Arrhenius came up with a hypothesis that they were caused by rising and falling carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere. And by virtue of trying to prove this, he actually created the first very rudimentary climate model and showed basically that as we, as humans, dump a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we would warm the planet.
And what did he think the results of global warming would be?
Well, he was quite sanguine about the whole thing. He was a Swede, as I mentioned, and he thought that the world would be better off for being warmer. And he also thought it would take a tremendously long time to make much of an impact. And that is owing, first of all, to the fact that, you know, compared to today, not that much CO2 was being emitted back in the 1890s. And also to the fact that he underestimated how much of that CO2 was going to remain in the atmosphere. He thought that the vast majority of it would be absorbed by the oceans. And that turns out not to be the case.
He did try to calculate how long it would take for humanity to double atmospheric CO2, an extremely important question to us today. What was his estimate?
He estimated it would take 3,000 years.
And what do we think now?
Now we think that CO2, we could reach sort of doubled CO2, which means doubled from pre-industrial levels by, you know, around at the rate we're going, or sometime in the middle of this century.
That's about 25 years from now. In this book, once you know that A is not for apple, it's for Arrhenius, you really want to find out what B is for. Please tell us.
Okay, well, B is for blah, blah, blah. And that refers to a kind of famous or viral speech that Greta Thunberg, another Swede, delivered at a in a an event that was a run-up to one of the climate, you know, big sets of climate negotiations. This one happened to have been, I believe, in Glasgow. And her point was, it's a very clever speech. I recommend that people watch it on YouTube. It's up there. Because she sort of offered all the slogans, the nice sounding slogans that people offered, you know, climate change is an opportunity, blah, blah, blah. And then as she went on, at the beginning, it seemed like she was actually endorsing that kind of sloganeering. And then she really turns on it, and it's interesting to watch the audience's reaction.
Our leaders, Greta Thunberg said, talk about net zero, but haven't really done anything significant to get us there. And your letter C is really the big reason why that is. In your book, I thought the letter C would be for carbon tax, but you go much deeper. In your book, C is for...
C is for capitalism. I was kind of lucky how these letters just kept appearing to me, I guess, or these words. They kind of made a nice sequence, I thought. So C is for capitalism, and as I'm sure many of your listeners are aware, you know, there's a very big debate in what I'll call, for lack of a better phrase, climate circles, about whether we can, you know, effectively tackle climate change using a model of green growth, whether we can just basically continue using the principles of capitalism, but greener, to tackle this problem, or whether that is impossible, whether, you know, growth, infinite growth on a finite planet. There's a very famous saying from an economist named Kenneth Boulding in the back in the 70s, the only people who believe on infinite growth on a finite planet are madmen and economists. So there's a, you know, big question about whether we can tackle climate change in the context of growth, or whether we need to start, you know, degrowing, or, you know, AKA shrinking.
So just to go back to the carbon tax for a minute, the idea here is the way to reduce carbon emissions is to use the power of the market to change the incentives, because there's profit to be made in solar and wind, and we can make fossil fuel production less profitable with a carbon tax or a tax on fossil fuels. You say here, the real problem is not just fossil fuels. You have a sentence, climate change can't be dealt with using the tools of capitalism because it is a product of capitalism. That is profound. Of course, the defenders of capitalism say it's just human nature for people to want more and better, not just for themselves, but for their families, for their kids. And I've heard you can't change human nature. What do you say to that?
Well, they may be right. I mean, once again, I don't have the answer to this question, you know, whether green growth is a viable strategy that will lead us, you know, to a better place, or whether that's not possible. I don't know the answer to that. It's, you know, increasingly, I think we have to be honest about it and say, you know, there's no evidence right now that we're going to deal effectively with this problem.
That leads us directly to the letter D. What is D for in your book?
D brings you right to despair, which I think is a very legitimate or very honest, you know, sort of response, but not a useful one. And that is why despair is not only unproductive, it is also a sin. And then we dispatch with D and despair and move on.
I want to move on, skip a few letters, and go to H. H is for hope in your book. It's also, of course, the title of your book, so we're not surprised by the time we get to H. I like Rebecca Solnit's definition of hope. She distinguishes between hope and optimism. Optimism is based on a confidence that you know what's going to happen, and of course, it's going to be good. In that way, she says, it's not so different from pessimism, based on the same idea that you know what's going to happen. It's going to be bad. But if you know what's going to happen, good or bad, you don't really need to do anything because, of course, it's going to happen anyway. Hope, in that sense, is the opposite, she says. It's based on the confidence that you don't know exactly what's going to happen. We do know, in this case, global warming will get worse. We don't know how much worse. We don't know how fast it will get worse. And we do know we've been surprised in the past when things happened that we never imagined. So hope gives us a motive for action. More than that, it makes action necessary. You make this point in your chapter N, and it's for narratives. What do you point to as a source of hope for you in this book?
Well, the chapter on H, you know, leans heavily on new technologies that are coming to market. I go in that chapter to a company, a startup that is trying to make these, you know, very powerful, heavy, gigantic batteries that rely on rust, basically rusting and then reverse rusting to provide what's called utility scale energy storage. Because if we're going to rely on solar and wind, then we need a lot of energy storage, since those are obviously intermittent sources of energy. So there are a lot of very smart people thinking about how to affect this transition. So they, this company Form Energy, which since I visited them, now is breaking ground on a factory to actually manufacture these batteries. So these things are moving forward. So that chapter focuses on these breakthroughs that could be very important.
And what is the cost of rust compared to lithium?
It's a whole hell of a lot cheaper. Iron is a lot. Iron is the most commonly, you know, mined metal on the planet. We mine a lot of iron.
One other big thing provides hope, going back a few letters in your alphabet to E. And in your book, what is E for?
E stands for electrify everything. And that is sort of the rallying cry. You can't really get the carbon out of fossil fuels, although, you know, we can talk about that, you know, whether you can store it or, you know, collect it and store it. But, you know, practically speaking, if you burn fossil fuels, you're producing carbon dioxide. So we need to move a lot of our energy infrastructure over to electricity, which could be produced by non-carbon producing sources.
Such as wind and solar. And tell us about the wind, the offshore wind industry that currently exists in the world and off the shore of New England.
Yes. Yeah, so I went out to a wind farm that's off the coast of Rhode Island. It's considered, you know, a very small one by today's standards, but it's an amazing, you know, sight when you're right up there against these enormous wind turbines, which were put up and effectively supply the power for Block Island. You're on Block Island, you know, that's where you're getting your power from. And, you know, as everyone knows, there are plans in the works for many massive wind farms off the East Coast of the U.S. and hopefully also off the West Coast of the U.S., although that raises different problems because the water's deeper. But, you know, even since I wrote this book, there have been snags in that owing to high interest rates and opposition from local groups. So some of these programs, some of these projects that were supposed to be in the works already are either on hold or have been canceled. So that, unfortunately, it has turned out to be kind of a mixed story.
So I want to take a step back and look at the form of this book. It's sort of like a children's book. And amazingly, given the topic, It's sort of fun to read.
Oh, thank you.
and the illustrations are wonderful. Was that always the plan? A fun book with great illustrations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the plan was to try to mix up, sort of mash up a lot of different genres: the kids' book, the, you know, apocalyptic book, the illustrated book. So it's playing with a lot of different forms, and I hope that readers get some pleasure out of that in what is often not a very pleasurable topic.
One last thing, the letter R. In your book, R is for what?
R is for Republicans. This is a discussion really of how climate change never seems to really rise to the top of the political agenda. We're definitely seeing that again, you know, and we will see it. I guess it's hard to see an absence, but I think we will hear a deafening absence of conversation about climate change. I don't think Biden thinks that it's going to win him a lot of votes in the swing states that he needs. And Donald Trump, of course, is, you know, just terrible on everything related to clean energy. But it's a discussion of how it never rises to the top of the political agenda, and also how polarized the issue is. And the issue has become, which obviously is ridiculous, since the fate of the planet would seem to be an issue that would really concern anyone, no matter what your political views. But this has become terribly, terribly polarized.
And what percentage of Republicans list climate change as the most important challenge facing the nation?
Well, in the particular poll that I cite, the percentage was zero.
In your book, T is not for Trump, but if it were my book, I would have T is for Trump, that making sure Trump is not reelected has to be the number one task of the climate movement.
Well, I think that that is a reasonable point to make. You know, when you write a book, you don't want to insert yourself into timely politics all the time, because, of course, that right. dates pretty quickly. But, we have, 6 months to go before the election, and it couldn't be a more important election for so many reasons, climate change being up there.
Elizabeth Colbert, her wonderful new book is H is for Hope, Climate Change from A to Z. Elizabeth, thanks for this book. Thanks for all your work. And thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Judith Butler may be the most famous feminist theorist in the world today. Now, Butler has a new book out with the provocative title, Who's Afraid of Gender? For comment, we turn to Katha Pollitt. Of course, she's a poet, essayist, and award-winning columnist for The Nation. Her most recent book is Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. She also publishes in the New York Times, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, where she wrote about Butler's new book. We reached her today at home in Manhattan. Katha, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, John.
Well, Judith Butler's main idea, first introduced in the book Gender Trouble in 1990, a book that is required reading in every gender studies program. The idea is that gender is socially constructed, not part of nature. Our ideas about femininity and masculinity derive from social relations of power. Femininity is performative. Words every gender studies student learns. Femininity is performative. But that's not exactly an original idea of Butler's. We should say an original idea of theirs, since that's their preferred pronoun.
Yes, she is now non-binary and only wonders why this didn't occur to her before.
So how far back do we find the idea that femininity is not part of nature?
Well, see, this is what is so infuriating. This is an old feminist idea put forward by dozens of second wave feminists.
And by John Stuart Mill in 1869, who wrote,
"What is now called the nature of women is an eminently artificial thing." So this is not a new idea. And yet she gets credit for it, which is very annoying. But, you know, she did take it farther. Because what she said isn't just, you know, your behavior, your gestures, your expectations, what people expect of you, your character, to some extent, your character, what's permitted to you and how you adapt to that, that's all she's socially set up. She said our very ideas of sex, physical, biological sex, are shaped in the same way. So the idea that you think of, a woman has a vagina. Well, why do you think that? You know, the fact that you think men don't have babies. Why do you think that? So, interestingly, that was the idea that really set people off. That was where sort of trans came in, and the idea that they're really, oh, I don't know, 6, 10, 100 different genders, because the term sex and the term gender are hopelessly confused with each other.
So let's talk about the new book, Who's Afraid of Gender? It's written in a much more accessible style than Gender Trouble was. What's the central argument here? Who is afraid of gender?
Well, first of all, let's not go overboard about how accessible that book is.
Okay.
It was a struggle. My husband, who is a world famous social theorist, as you once told me,
I did.
He read it too, just to keep me company. So we both struggled along. So her basic idea is that gender, what she calls the phantasm of gender, is a collection of fears surrounding heterosexuality, the family, men and women, how people should behave around those entities, that this is being utilized by fascism to distract people from their real problems.
Now, I looked up the meaning of phantasm, which appears 41 times in the introduction to this book alone. A phantasm is an illusion, a ghostly illusion. So the fascists are weaponizing an illusion about gender to conceal, as you say, their real purpose, seizing and holding power. And the fascists that Butler is talking about include who?
Oh, Viktor Orban of Hungary, Giorgio Meloni of Italy, but especially the Pope. She really has it in for the Pope in this book.
And do you consider the gender phantasm as crucial to the global far right as Butler does?
You know, I actually do not. I think it's in there, definitely, along with a lot of other stuff, like racism and nationalism and so on. But I don't think it's the key thing. I think the key is it is this kind of mixture of nationalism, quote, patriotism, unquote, with longing for ethnic purity, hatred of, quote, elites, unquote. That's very big. I mean, you'll notice that in a lot of these now neo-fascist leaning countries, it's the people in the countryside who've been left behind, as in our own, who are keen on all on Jair Bolsonaro and all those people.
So how would you explain why Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is so popular if the key is not weaponizing gender?
Well, he's a very clever politician. And one of the things that he has said and that he does is there aren't going to be any Muslims here. No Muslims. You know, that's the ethnic and racial and religious purity aspect of it. And then he does this thing where he, at the same time as he's saying, the birth rate, big problem, we need more Hungarians and you women have got to produce more Hungarians. At the same time as he's saying that, he is providing families, especially large families, with lots and lots of social services and benefits, and including ones that make it easier for women to work. So it's like he's anti-feminist, you've got to have kids, but he's pro-feminist, we're going to help women work. So it's a complicated picture, and I don't think you can reduce it all to just, the gender phantasm.
And what about Trump? His idea of femininity is, the 50s Playboy centerfold, Stormy Daniels, but I don't see him preoccupied with, trans bathroom issues or with banning the book Heather Has Two Mommies from the school library.
No, but it is true that the people who want to do those things think he's just great. And they think that despite his being, as I say, libertine in chief. I mean, you've got I think it's up to 80% of Christian fundamentalists are for him, even though he violates every precept that they have, except the one that says, I'm going to give you lots of money for your parochial and religious schools, and we're going to ban abortion.
One person in American politics who is not afraid of gender, let me just remind everybody, Joe Biden, the 81-year-old Catholic who declared recently that Easter Sunday this year was Transgender Day of Visibility. The right said he proclaimed that Easter Sunday was Trans Day, but that's not really true. Transgender Day of Visibility, TDOV it's called, is held every year on March 31st, whereas the date for Easter Sunday changes every year. And this year they just happened to coincide. I just want to quote Biden for a minute on his proclamation on this year's Trans Day. "We honor the extraordinary courage and contributions of transgender Americans and reaffirm our nation's commitment to forming a more perfect union where all people are treated equally throughout their lives. I am proud that my administration has stood for justice from the start, working to ensure that the LGBTQI plus community can live openly in safety with dignity and respect. I am proud to have appointed transgender leaders to my administration, to have ended the ban on transgender Americans serving openly in our military. Transgender Americans are part of the fabric of our nation. They deserve and are entitled to the same rights and freedoms as every other American, including the most fundamental freedom to be their true selves." Close quote, Joe Biden. Judith Butler could not have said it better.
She could not, indeed, could not have said it better. I mean, this, but here you see the starkness of the difference, because while Joe Biden invited Dylan Mulvaney to the White House, I mean, of all the transgender people in the country, he chose this TikTok heroine who saying that, you know, this is her 365 days of girlhood when she's actually a man in her mid-30s who knows nothing about girlhood and has never been one. So he had invited her to the White House. Meanwhile, when Dylan Mulvaney did that little advertisement for Budweiser Light, the right got all excited and succeeded in lowering the stock value of Budweiser by a considerable amount. So there's a big stark difference here, which I think is a very bad thing. I think it fuels the inability to have a real discussion about these things, because, you know, if you're a liberal or a leftist, you don't want to give any aid and comfort to the other side, and presumably they feel the same way.
So let's get back to the book and its argument. We said the answer to the question, who's afraid of gender, for Judith Butler is fascists. Now, we call people we don't like fascists probably way too often. How does Butler define it?
She says that fascism is about stripping people of the rights they require to live. Now, if you define it that way, almost every society in the world has been fascist, including for large stretches of our own, when we denied Black people and in some ways women the right to have a decent life and within their rights. So that is not a useful way to define this term. I'm sort of pedantic about this. I think fascism is a historical term, and there's much to be gained by protecting, by, you know, continuing to see it that way. I mean, you need an autocratic government. You need a big army. You need a lot of people putting other people in prison and concentration camps. You need an idea of the state as the property of a certain ethnicity. I mean, like in Germany, where they took away the citizenship of Jews. All that is fascism. Simply not treating as equals everybody in the society. That's not fascism. That's pretty much normal life.
That's normal life. Okay. And then I want to talk a little more about trans issues. If we agree that all of gender identity is a social construction, if it's all performative, doesn't that mean that trans identity is also socially produced and also a performance?
Well, that was a point I made in my essay that I thought was particularly clever, because it's this idea of authenticity. What is authenticity? What is it to be your real self? To me, these are very shadowy and vague things. How do you know when you've achieved your real self? What happens if you change your mind about what your real self is? But the way Judith Butler has it set up is the only kind of authenticity that is bedrock and cannot be questioned, and you are the authority on it, is trans. And that just seems very strange to me. Why would it be that?
You also have some criticisms of Butler on the debate about trans exclusionary feminists. These are feminists who reject the claims of people who have transitioned, especially from male to female. Please explain what this is about and what your argument is with Butler.
Well, the gender critical feminists who are called TERFs for trans exclusionary radical feminists by their enemies, but prefer the very awkward term gender critical feminists instead, they do not believe that you can change, literally change sex. So they are very sensitive to ways that trans women, as they would say, are invading the space of women. For example, Leah Thomas winning that swim, you know, and other athletes transitioning sort of maybe, and then taking prizes in women's sporting competitions. They don't like the idea of trans women in women's prisons. And it is definitely true that some men, and that part of it is some men who are not trans, they will claim to be trans, claim to be women to get into those spaces. So, you know, they are very sensitive to that kind of thing. And there were famous cases of that, like the We Spa case in Los Angeles, where a woman who complained that there was a man in the ladies' lounging area of the spa was told, oh, well, we, you know, you can't say that, you're out. And there was a huge fight about this. And then it turned out that the guy actually was a sex offender, a registered sex offender. He was not trans. So that sort of thing does happen. And then the other people on the other side will say, well, this is so rare. You cannot make this, you know, you can't make that be the way you think about these things. So anyway, what Judith Butler says is that the gender critical feminists are big reactionaries. They're allied with, you know, the Pope and all those other bad people that she mentioned.
I want to look at exactly what she said here. Judith Butler said, your criticism of her here was unfair. This was on Brian Lehrer's show on WNYC. She said, I'm quoting, quote, I have great respect for Katha Pollitt, but I am surprised she didn't read the text carefully. I have never said that trans exclusionary feminists are fascists. I think they do have to ask themselves why their alliance is with Putin and Orban rather than with gay, lesbian, queer, transgender, nonconforming people, close quote. So what is this alliance she's talking about? What Butler says is their arguments ally with right-wing authoritarians. But can arguments make alliances?
That's a very metaphysical question. But I think he's wrong on so many grounds here. First of all, a lot of these gender-critical feminists are leftists. A lot of them are lesbians. They are not right. I mean, there are a lot, of course, right-wing people involved in being in opposition to trans, but these particular people are not. If you say, well, the most famous one, J.K. Rowling. You know, J.K. Rowling is now like the devil to a lot of people, but she's actually a really good person. And she's very feminist, and she does all kinds of good works in the world besides writing these books that are beloved. And it's extremely unfair to say, well, she's right up there with Putin. Now, she has said that I claim that these women are fascists. No, I said she says they are fascist adjacent, not the same thing. Of course, they're not fascists. And she wouldn't say that. But she, who is misreading who here, I would say.
What are your concluding thoughts on this?
Well, my concluding thoughts on this are several. One is, if you're going to have coalition politics, which she at some point seemed to be calling for this, you have to acknowledge that people can disagree about some things and agree about others. For example, I am very much against the death penalty, and so is that Pope. Am I in his camp? Is he in my camp? What are we doing? No, we agree about one thing. And she doesn't seem to get that. She seems to think what a coalition is you have to agree with me. So that's not what a coalition is. And I'm surprised that she doesn't realize that, because she does a great deal of political work. The other thing I'd like to say is I think that this subject has become so fraught, so poisonous, that we can't even have a conversation about it without getting into a huge amount of trouble. And I think that's really wrong. And I think it's counterproductive. I think if we're going to move forward and figure out some way to all live together, we have to be able to talk about things instead of just denying that they're the case. What if it is true that women and trans do not always have the same interests? What if there is a conflict? I think it doesn't help to just say, oh, no, there's never a conflict. There's no problem here. Because for too many people, there does seem to be a conflict.
Katha Pollitt, she wrote about Judith Butler's new book, Who's Afraid of Gender, for The Atlantic. Katha, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
One more thing. It's time for your Minnesota moment. News from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Today's news, St. Paul has created a guaranteed income pilot program for artists. For 18 months, starting now, 25 artists in the St. Paul neighborhoods of Frogtown and Rondo will each receive $500 a month in unrestricted support. The artists are part of a new pilot program from an organization called Springboard for the Arts. The program was inspired by the City of St. Paul's People's Prosperity Pilot and the Mayors for a Guaranteed Income Network. More about them in a minute. It will not be funded by tax dollars at this point, but by two local foundations, the McKnight Foundation and the Bush Foundation, which are both based in the Twin Cities. Over the past year, creative workers in the region have received more than $1.5 million in direct aid on an emergency basis because of the COVID pandemic. The announcement of the Guaranteed Income Pilot Program for Artists comes just a couple of days after the NEA, and that's the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Bureau of Economic Analysis released a report about the toll that the pandemic has taken on employment in the arts. In the third quarter of 2020, 27% of musicians were unemployed, along with 52% of actors and 55% of dancers and choreographers. Under this guaranteed income program for artists, recipients will be selected at random from an eligible pool of artists who have already received support from the Emergency Relief Fund of the Springboard Program, and at least 75% of them will be Black, Native, or people of color. St. Paul is not alone in doing this. On March 25th, San Francisco announced its own guaranteed income pilot program for artists. That will start in May. They'll fund 130 local artists in neighborhoods hit hardest by the pandemic, and they will each receive $1,000 a month for 6 months. This program is taking applications through April 15th. As far as we know, San Francisco and St. Paul are the only cities in the United States to establish guaranteed income pilot programs for artists. The groups that are supporting this, Springboard for the Arts, is an economic and community development organization in Minnesota. They describe themselves as for artists and by artists. They have offices in Fergus Falls, also in St. Paul. They say their goal is to help artists make a living and a life, and to help communities connect to the creative power of artists. This Guaranteed Income for Artists program is part of St. Paul's People's Prosperity Guaranteed Income Pilot. This provides 150 families in St. Paul with $500 a month in guaranteed income for 18 months. This is being offered to families participating in a different program, College Bound St. Paul. This is the city's college savings initiative, which is providing every child born to a St. Paul resident on or after January 1st, 2020, with a college savings account and a $50 seed deposit. The families will get, in addition to $500 a month, They'll get a $10 bonus deposit to each child's college-bound St. Paul account. The idea of St. Paul's Guaranteed Income Pilot Project is simple. Give cash to families on a no-strings-attached basis so they can buy the things they need. The program website explains, quote, "For far too long, too many programs that provide support for poor people have focused on telling families how much, where, and what to spend their money on. But families know best what they need, so this program gives them the flexibility to determine how to spend these resources," close quote. And this is part of a nationwide program of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. They argue, quote, "This is our New Deal moment. Everyone deserves an income floor through a guaranteed income." And they quote Martin Luther King, quote, "The simplest approach to poverty will prove to be the most effective. The solution to poverty is to abolish it directly with a guaranteed income," close quote, Martin Luther King. Mayors for a Guaranteed Income had its first guaranteed income pilot project in Stockton, California. This is the work of the famous mayor, Michael Tubbs, who started this in June 2020. It now consists of mayors of dozens of cities, including heroes of ours like Chakwe Antar Lumumba in Jackson, Mississippi. Mayors in big cities like Philadelphia, Dallas, Houston, Baltimore, and Pittsburgh. In Southern California, the mayors who participate are from Long Beach, West Hollywood, and Compton, and also Eric Garcetti of Los Angeles. The initial funding for Mayors for a Guaranteed Income came from Jack Dorsey, the billionaire CEO of Twitter. He donated $3 million to help fund Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, the only mayor in Minnesota to be part of Mayors for a Guaranteed Income is Melvin Carter of St. Paul. This has been your Minnesota Moment, a special feature of this program. That's it for Living in the USA for today. Our producer and social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Our audio editor is Alan Minsky. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you missed part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at applepodcast.com, Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.